Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it's March 24th, Wednesday. And next week is what? Spring break. So please don't come to class. Campus will be open, but I don't know if the library is going to be open. Teachers probably won't be here. You can't get into the labs or anything like that. So today's our last lecture on nervous system, the introduction to nervous system, and that will take you up to the next test sometime today when we finish this chapter. Probably won't take all day today to do that. And when is the next test? Anybody know when the next test is? It's a week from today, except we got spring break, so it's 2 weeks from today. It's on a Wednesday, yeah. So it's on a Wednesday in 2 weeks. So come back from spring break, we'll have a lecture on Monday, then on Wednesday we got another test. Which one is that? That's the third one. Yeah, it's the third one. Okay. So I just want to make sure everybody's kind of tracking with that. So study a little bit every day during spring break. And even the online stuff, you know, we keep going with the online material. And most students tell me that the nervous system is the hardest part of the class. Might not be the hardest for you, but you know how you make something easier? Just spend a little time with it every day. Don't like go away for a week and try to come back, because then you got to start at the beginning. So that's one way to make it easier. All right, so don't forget to sign the sign-in sheet. All right, so let's go over the scheme again really fast that we have right here. What are the two major divisions, structural divisions of the nervous system? Central versus peripheral, right? And what are the two main divisions of central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. Okay. And peripheral nervous system, how could we break the peripheral nervous system down? Sensory and motor. Which way does information move if it's a sensory fiber? Which way? Yeah, but which way does it move? Which way does it move in terms of the structure? From the periphery into your central nervous system, that's sensory. And motor is what? From the brain out to your peripheral nervous system somehow. That's right. And we learned some different neurons, different shapes of neurons that transmit information. And remember, which way can information go along a neuron? One way. Yeah, it's a one-way street. Which way does it go? Dendrite, cell body, axon, then out the axon terminus. And remember, we looked at the axon terminus last time a little bit. We call that the synapse, right? Okay, and then what's another name for sensory? And afferent, and I'm just going to be using those terms pretty much exclusively, I think. Afferent with an A, and motor are efferent neurons, right? Okay. In terms of the motor nervous system, what are the two main divisions for sending information out to the periphery? What are the two?
Somatic.
Where does that go? What is the effector organ for the somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle only. And somatic means it has another connotation to it. It's not the literal meaning for somatic. Somatic literally means body, as opposed to body cavity. All right, so somatic, the connotation implies that it's voluntary, right? So it's voluntary. So skeletal muscle is the only thing that you have voluntary control of in your body. And so the other nervous system goes to everything else. What's the other nervous system?
Autonomic
nervous system. And you could probably call it automatic, but you wouldn't be right. But it is automatic. You don't have to think about it. What are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? I don't know if I have it on the slide. Oh, it's just off the slide. You can't just read it. You have to know. How about skeletal muscle? No, because that belongs to that's under the control of the somatic nervous system. Cardiac muscle is one. Smooth muscle is another. And glands. Those are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system. All right. Well, we said that. Oh, what are the two main cells that make up nervous tissue? Neurons and neuroglia. Yeah, make sure you can say neuroglia. And which one transmit electrical information very fast over long distances? The neurons, right? So that's really kind of where we're studying right now. And neurons, we said, work by electrical signals. I don't have the right slide. Oh yeah, this is a good slide to start with right here. How do I make it just a little bit bigger? Here. All right, so I've got two neurons back to back right here, and this first one right here is what we call the... Okay, these are dendrites. These are the processes sticking off the cell body. Okay, but I see two neurons. They're connected to each other via a synapse. What do we call the first neuron? The presynaptic neuron, and then this is the postsynaptic neuron, and they communicate with each other through this synapse. Now, what kind of synapse was that that we talked about? The most common kind. I tell you what. Oh, I see people thinking. There are two kinds of synapses. What are the two major kinds of synapses? Electrical is one, and chemical is another. All right, so this particular synapse is a chemical synapse because information has to flow through this gap right here as a chemical signal. What do we call, what's a general name for that chemical signal that moves across the synapse? The neurotransmitter. And maybe we talked about a specific one. Oh, in the muscle chapter we did. Okay, what's a good example of a neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine is a good example of a neurotransmitter. And there are others like norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine. Maybe you're familiar with some of these. Okay. All right, so how is information? What's the general form of information moving down a dendrite through a cell body and then down an axon? What's the simplest way to think of that signal? What's the nature of that signal? And we're going to start talking about that today. It's an electrical signal. And that's why it moves so fast, because it's an electrical signal. And then as it moves across the synapse, that electrical signal, does it get converted into a different kind of signal? Yeah, what kind of signal? A chemical signal. And then, what about the signal going through the postsynaptic neuron? That's an electrical signal again. So it goes electrical, chemical through the synapse, and then the postsynaptic neuron transmits information as another electrical signal. All right, so we need to talk about some of that electricity going on in here. And there were some ions that I wrote on the board last time. Okay, because we said that every cell in your body, if it's alive, acts like a battery. A battery, how many terminals does a battery have? It's got two, and how are you going to find out if the battery's alive or not? Yeah, you test it. How? By measuring the charge, the voltage across those two terminals. And if the two terminals are exactly at the same voltage, then the battery is dead. But if the voltage is different, then it has stored energy inside of it. Okay? Kind of the same thing for cells. Look, we see that inside the cell, it is negative. That's like being one terminal. And outside the cell, it is positive. That's just like a battery. So if we measure a cell and we can see a voltage difference across the cell membrane right here, we can say that cell is alive. But if the voltage is the same, what could you tell me about that cell? You know, it's dead. Okay, it's not going to behave properly. All right, so there are two ions responsible for maintaining this battery nature of the cell. And what are these two ions? Here's one that represents sodium. Okay, here is the periodic table that you don't have to know in this class. But if you look for Na, it says sodium right there. Okay. And what about K right here? That's potassium. All right, so this slide illustrates that in a living cell, sodium is going to be at high concentration outside the cell, and potassium is going to be high inside the cell. That means that potassium is low outside and sodium is low inside. That means the same thing. Okay. All right, so this is what we call the resting membrane potential. So that's what I have on the board right here. Number one, resting membrane potential. Sometimes we just call that RMP. And I could ask you what ions are responsible for making the resting membrane potential. And you would say sodium and potassium. And you should probably become familiar with those abbreviations for those chemicals, right? Na for sodium and K for potassium. It's going to require a little memorization to do that. Furthermore, the resting membrane potential is not just due to those two ions, but a difference in concentration of those two on either side of the cell membrane. So you should be able to tell me, where is sodium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. Where is potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell. And that's what I want you to know about resting membrane potential. Okay? And In order to get ions in those concentrations across the membrane like that, it takes energy to do that. Guess where that energy comes from? Mitochondria, because what do mitochondria produce? ATP. So it requires ATP to do that. That's why when the cell runs out of energy, these concentrations equalize and the membrane potential disappears. So you don't want any of your cells to run out of ATP, that's for sure. All right, well, what can a cell do with this resting membrane potential? That takes us to another kind of voltage event that we call an action potential. And an action potential is due to those two ions as well, but it's a behavior of the ions. These ions are going to be moving around, hence, we don't call it a resting membrane potential, we call it an action potential, because these ions are going to do something. They're going to jump around in there. And when the cell gets excited, when it gets stimulated, there are tunnels that open up or channels that open up that allow sodium to enter the cell. And what you don't see on this diagram right here is that this number one really should be a what? Should be a plus sign. All right? And it runs inside the cell because if you look at the resting cell right here, you see that the inside is very negative. Now, I do want you to know something about opposite electrical charges. If charges are opposite, do they repel each other or do they attract each other? They actually attract each other, right? To neutralize each other. So when the cell is stimulated and a channel opens up, the sodium, which has a positive charge, does what? It gets pulled inside the cell because the inside of the cell is negative. All right? So that, and when the positive charge goes inside the cell, right, that kind of neutralizes this charge. All right, so an action potential starts when sodium enters the cell. And after a little bit of time, okay, potassium channels open up and potassium leaves the cell. And then that changes the electrical properties of the cell and brings it back to the resting condition right here. All right, so I do want you to know that an action potential is due to two ions. What are the two ions?
Sodium.
Yeah, sodium and potassium. Okay, but action means something's happening. What about sodium? What's it doing? It's entering the cell, right? Entering the cell. And what about potassium? Leaving the cell. All right, so there are two parts to an action potential. One, two. First, sodium enters the cell. The second part is potassium leaving. This first part right here, you got to know what we call that. That's called? That's pretty close. Okay. But the way we name it is by the nature of the electrical event. All right. And we can see that the charge is going away when sodium enters. So we call that depolarization. So the first part of an action potential is depolarization. I got this in your notes, but I'm just going to write it down right here. And that's followed by potassium leaving the cell, and we call that, and it takes the cell back to its resting condition, we call that repolarization. All right, so we got depolarization and repolarization. Good. All right, so sodium and potassium. What's another name for sodium and potassium? What's a general kind of class of compounds that they belong to? They are electrolytes because they are ions. Ions have some kind of electrical charge on them, and both sodium and potassium has a positive charge. So they are electrolytes. All right, so do you think it's pretty important for everybody, like if you get sick and you're in a hospital, do you think it's important for physicians to know what the concentrations of your electrolytes are in your body? Oh, absolutely, because it determines the whole electrical properties of nerves and your heart and everything else. And if that electrical property is disturbed, then your brain is disturbed, muscle is disturbed, the heart contraction is disturbed. Okay. All right, so we said that a neuron does what? Receives information and then transmits it very fast as an electrical signal down an axon. And this is why, because axons can develop action potentials, and an action potential can actually move down an axon. And that's what we see on this slide right here. All right, see, at the very beginning of an action potential where it begins to depolarize, it just happens at one small location on an axon. And as this area depolarizes, it causes this area to depolarize. All right, so can you see that over here? It starts to depolarize, and when this area over here depolarizes, guess what? This area depolarizes. And when this area depolarizes, what happens to this one? It depolarizes as well. So that area of depolarization can sweep down an axon, and look at this arrow. It means what? It's a one-way street. This electrical signal can move down an axon from the cell body down to the axon terminus, and it's a really fast event. And then that's followed by repolarization when potassium moves. So when an action potential is propagating down a nerve axon, we call that something. What is an action potential in motion called? In motion meaning it's sweeping down an axon. That is a nerve impulse. Okay, so that's a nerve impulse. So you got to be able to break some of these things down, like figure out what are the two kinds of potentials that we just talked about. Resting membrane potential, when there are no signals being transmitted. You should know what's responsible for that. What develops the resting membrane potential?
Sodium
and potassium, some ions, right? And you got to know which one is high outside, which one is high inside. And then when that cell gets stimulated, that produces an action potential. How many phases does an action potential have? Yeah, it's got two. That's good. That's not too many. And what's responsible, what is the first phase called? Yeah, what's the second phase called? Repolarization. And then you got to know what ions are responsible for those two events. Like depolarization is due to?
Sodium,
but more importantly, what's sodium doing to make it an action potential?
Entering.
It's entering, right? And then repolarization is due to potassium, but it's doing something to make it an action potential. It's leaving, right? And that event can sweep down a nerve axon, and when it does, we call that a nerve impulse, right? All right, so when you get into physiology, you're going to be really interested in all these electrical events. Going to look into it in a lot more detail. All right, but this is just a nice introduction for you. Okay. Let me see what the next bit of information is. Okay. Well, we saw that some neurons, if we look at their axons, so let's go find a neuron someplace. Where's a nice neuron someplace? Here's a good one. Okay, oh, so I see some neurons and some neuroglia. Actually, I see one neuron. Who can tell me what neuron this is right here?
Unipolar.
Yeah, that's a unipolar. See, we just have one process coming out of the cell body, so this is a unipolar neuron. What's the function of this kind of neuron? Is it afferent or efferent or association?
Afferent.
It's afferent, meaning it's a sensory neuron. It's bringing information into the central nervous system. Okay, and these little pearls right here, what are these things? Yeah, these are neuroglial cells, and they're Schwann cells, and they're wrapping insulation around the axon, right? What do we call that insulation? Yeah, myelin. Okay, now let's talk about why these Schwann cells are there. Okay, remember when an action potential starts, sodium has to enter the cell, right, when it depolarizes, and potassium has to leave. But if there's this insulation right here, sodium and potassium can't move across the membrane in this location. It's prevented by this myelin sheath. So sodium and potassium can only move in and out of the cell at these junctions between the Schwann cells. What the heck do we call those things? They're gaps. The gaps between the Schwann cells are called nodes of Ranvier. And that's where sodium and potassium can enter and leave the cell, all right? So if an axon is myelinated, the action potential does not have to move down the axon molecule by molecule by molecule. It can actually hop from one node of Ranvier to the next, from one node to the next node, to the next node, to the next node. And as that action potential is hopping or skipping down the axon, all right, what do you think that means? It has to do with the speed of that transmission of the nerve impulse. Do you think it's slower, faster, or the same? Yeah, think of you maybe having to walk up a flight of stairs, and you got to step on every stair. Okay, that's pretty slow. But say you're strong, and you can actually jump, right, every fourth step or something, right? So you can go four stairs at a time. What would be faster if you're strong enough? Yeah, skipping up the stairs, right? So this is an advantage that most mammals have compared to other kinds of animals, is that when our axons transmit information as a nerve impulse, it's fast because our axons are what we say, what? Myelinated. They're myelinated axons, so nerve impulse can skip, and it can be up to maybe 300 times faster compared to if it's an unmyelinated axon. So what would you rather be? Or how would you like to have your nervous system operate? Faster or slower? Would you like to have a fast computer or a slow computer? Fast is always a lot better, right? So our nervous systems are fast because of myelination. Okay, when an action potential can skip from node of Ranvier to node of Ranvier, we call that saltatory conduction. Saltatory conduction is really fast. And if a nerve fiber is not myelinated, it cannot transmit an action potential via saltatory conduction. We say it's continuous conduction. So continuous conduction is slow. Saltatory is fast. All right, so that's the function of this myelin right here. So let's relate that to structure. Let's think of that structural functional relationship. What structures allow for fast transmission? Fast transmission is like function, physiology. But that's due to certain structures. What structures allow for saltatory conduction? The myelin sheath, due to those Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system. And what produces saltatory conduction in the central nervous system? It was another kind of neuroglial cell. Schwann cells aren't in the central nervous system. Oligodendrocytes. Yeah, oligodendrocytes. Okay, so that's a huge advantage. But you know what? Some people have a problem with maintaining this myelin sheath around their nerves in the central nervous system. The oligodendrocytes actually start to get destroyed. And that messes up the timing and the speed of how information is transmitted between different parts of the brain. And we think that that's an autoimmune disease where somebody's own immune system mistakes the myelin around their axons and destroys it. Anybody know what that condition is called? Pretty common, yeah. It's called multiple sclerosis. Okay, and that's one of the reasons why multiple sclerosis is partly treated by immunosuppressant therapy, maybe steroids or something like that, to help protect the myelin sheath around certain parts of that person's brain. Okay, so this certainly is really important and very common. Okay. Nervous system terms. I'm going to come back to nervous system terms. That's the last thing I'm going to talk about. Okay, a nerve. What the heck is a nerve? All right, a nerve is not just a cell. A nerve cell and a nerve are totally different things. Okay, but a nerve is a group of nerve cells that are going someplace in your periphery, maybe along your arm or something. And so let's look at the structure of a nerve. It kind of might remind you of the structure of a muscle. Ah, here it is. So you should know some of these things. All right, so a nerve is really an organ. Because why? It has nervous tissue. It's got connective tissue, right? Blood is a connective tissue, so there are blood vessels in a nerve. And in these blood vessels, there's smooth muscle. So there's muscle. So what do you call something that is made up of various kinds of tissues?
Multi.
Yeah, it's multi. It's what we call an organ, right? An organ, you have to put different tissues together to perform a certain kind of function. Okay. All right, so here is a nerve. And surrounding the whole nerve is connective tissue we call the epineurium. Right, and then if we look inside the epineurium, we see other structures, like bundles of things. Guess what we call these bundles? Yeah, these are fascicles, just like muscles have fascicles in them. Right, nerves have fascicles, but not of muscle fibers, but of nerve fibers. Yeah, nerve fibers instead. Okay. So the connective tissue sheath around a fascicle is what we call the perineurium. And if we look inside the perineurium, we see all these individual nerve fibers right here. And there is even a connective tissue sheath around every nerve fiber. And that's what we call the endoneurium, right? So you got epi on the outside, peri around the fascicles, and endoneurium around each individual muscle fiber. And then, of course, a lot of fibers are going to have their own myelin sheath due to these. What kind of cells make the myelin sheath? Yeah, Schwann cell, because a nerve is always going to be in the peripheral nervous system. Nerves we don't find in the central nervous system. Okay, we're going to find other kinds of things. So think of a nerve as being all these electrical cables carrying information long distances in a very fast fashion. Right, but if, since it's living tissue, it needs a blood supply. It needs oxygen and nutrients in order to maintain the health of these neurons right here. All right, so this is probably an exam figure. I'm probably pretty sure it is. Okay. All right, let's look at some reflexes, response loops. What does a response loop always start with? What does a response loop always start with? A stimulus, right? Okay. And in order for you to perceive some kind of stimulus, what do you need? You need a receptor, exactly right. And there's different kinds of energy you're going to be receptive to. You have receptors for light, so that you can see things. You have receptors for vibrations, so that you can hear things. You have pain receptors in your skin, so that you can feel when you have tissue damage. Why is that a fantastic thing? Well, so that if you're experiencing tissue damage, you can remove your body from that damaging stimulus, right? So that's real important. All right, so here is a response loop, and this is kind of the picture that we started with in this chapter right here. Right, a response loop always starts with a stimulus, and in this particular circumstance, what is this stimulus right here? Is it sound? Is it light? Is it temperature? It is touch, and you might say, well, it's pain even, right? That little needle right there, that's the stimulus. And what allows you to perceive that stimulus? It is a receptor, right? So as a matter of fact, in this response loop, number one, you should really label as stimulus, right? So if this was a physiology class where we're interested in function, we would always start with stimulus. Since this is anatomy, they start with receptor because that's part of the structure. But you might as well just start, say, number one is stimulus, right? All right, so we have stimulus activating this receptor, right? But we want that information to go into our central nervous system. So the receptor passes that information on to the afferent neuron. What's the shape of that? What kind of shape does an afferent neuron take? What kind of shape is it? What kind of cell? Multipolar, bipolar, or unipolar?
Unipolar.
Okay, the sensory neuron is always going to be a unipolar. Unipolar. We're going to go over that a bunch so that it's second nature to you. And do you see that unipolar neuron anywhere on this slide? Let me zoom in. Ah, look at this guy right here. I lost a cursor when I do that, but you see it right there? That's a nice unipolar neuron. Here's the cell body of that unipolar neuron. What do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? That's a ganglion, right? So, and this is in your back, so this is posterior, this is anterior. So this ganglion right here, we call a dorsal root ganglia. We're going to talk about that more in just a little bit. All right, so here is that afferent neuron bringing information in. Oh, what is this junction right here between these two neurons? Okay, what is that? That is a synapse. That's the synapse, so think of all the little parts of a synapse that we talked about. That's going to transmit information to this neuron. And this neuron, notice, is completely within the central nervous system. There's no part of it in the peripheral nervous system. So when we have a neuron completely and entirely enclosed within the central nervous system, we call that is it a sensory neuron? Is it a motor neuron? No, it's neither one of those. That's what we call an interneuron, or maybe an association neuron. Either one of those two terms, association neuron or interneuron. And then that's going to pass the signal. It's going to make a decision on what to do. What would be a good decision if you have this damaging stimulus right here? What would be a good decision for this interneuron to make? Move your body away from the stimulus, right? And so the way that you can do that is to contract some muscles. So this neuron right here stimulates a motor neuron. What's another name for motor neuron? It's efferent. It's going to be an efferent neuron going to this effector. In this particular case, this effector is? Yeah, what kind of muscle? Skeletal muscle, right? So it causes the skeletal muscle to contract, moving this body region away from this damaging stimulus. What do you call it when this muscle contracts? It's contraction, yeah, when it contracts. All right. This whole loop starts with a stimulus. What does it end with? A response when this effector contracts, right? So contraction of the effector is what we call a response. So maybe go ahead and write that in. You got stimulus up over here, and this response loop always ends with a response when the effector carries out the command from the integration center right here, which is in the central nervous system. Okay, so that's a pretty nice response loop, as long as you modify it with stimulus and response down over here. Okay, so there are a number of different kinds of reflexes. Reflexes happen at the level of the spinal cord. Okay, and where, do you know where you have consciousness? Where do you make your conscious decisions? Like, you hear the alarm clock in the morning and you're going to say, oh, am I going to go to class today or not go to class today? Oh, it's really nice outside. I'll get up, but do I go to class or not go to class?
Brain.
Okay, yes, your central nervous system, in particular the brain, makes all of those kinds of decisions. But there's another part of your central nervous system, which is your spinal cord. The spinal cord does make decisions for you without your conscious control, without your conscious awareness of it. And that's really good because it means that when it makes a decision, it does it really fast. Like when you are experiencing some kind of painful stimulus, you don't want that painful stimulus to have to go all the way up to the brain to have you realize what you're feeling and then have you make a conscious decision. Because in the meantime, what's happening down over here? You're sustaining even more damage to your body. So reflex involves a spinal cord, which is really fast and automatic, and it happens even without your conscious awareness of it. Maybe you've grabbed something hot on the stove or something, and just as you're realizing, oh, maybe you're burning yourself, what's happening to your hand? It's actually moving away already, or you're dropping the pan on the floor, right? Because this kind of response happens very fast because it doesn't have to go all the way up to the brain. It gets taken care of at the level of the spinal cord. Okay, but this interneuron right here not only makes a decision and sends information to the effector to move away from the damaging stimulus, this interneuron also shares information that goes up to your brain so that you have the perception of it as well. That's not shown on this diagram, right? But there are collaterals of this axon that go up to the brain so that you can perceive it as well. Okay, so here are a couple different kinds of reflexes. This one on the left-hand side is what we call a monosynaptic reflex. These are the fastest because here you see a nice sensory or afferent neuron bringing information in, and it directly synapses on the efferent neuron. There is no interneuron here at all. This is the fastest kind of response. For instance, have you ever seen a doctor and they took a hammer and pounded your knee? Okay, and right, that stimulates, oh, this muscle right here. What muscle is that?
Rectus femoris.
It's going to contract. And when it contracts, what's the action of the rectus femoris?
Extension
of the knee. Yeah, extension of the knee. And you should probably know the origin and insertion of this rectus femoris right here. All right, so that would be an example of the knee-jerk reflex, and that's a monosynaptic reflex. Most reflexes are polysynaptic reflexes. Okay? Like, for instance, this withdrawal reflex from a painful stimulus. You see the first synapse is here. Here's the second synapse, which causes the contraction of the biceps. Right? What's the action of the biceps here? Flexion of the forearm. Yeah, or flexion at the elbow. And you should probably know origin insertion of the biceps. That's a really good one to know. All right, so since we have two synapses right here, we call that a polysynaptic reflex. And reflexes can get more complicated. For instance, if you're receiving painful stimulus on one hand, okay, maybe my right hand, if I pick up something really damaging, that's going to withdraw from the stimulus. But with your other arm, right, you might actually push away. We call that a cross-extensor reflex. So there will be neurons that go across the spinal cord through this little bridge right here. See this little bridge? There'll be neurons that go over to this side of your body that are going to excite. Oh, let's think of this for the exam and the practicum. Okay? If this arm is flexing to withdraw the hand, what muscles on the other side of your body are going to be stimulated to push? To push away. So if this arm is flexing, what is the other arm going to do? It's going to extend. What muscles are going to be stimulated for extension? Like the triceps brachii, right? So there are nerves all wired into those muscles just to do that kind of activity, okay? That's what we call a cross-extensor reflex. Okay, so we're not going to pay too much attention to that, but just to give you a little feel for what's going on. Okay, so make sure you know these different steps of a response loop. Okay, let's talk about some different kinds of circuits in your body. I just kind of alluded to some of these different kinds of circuits. Let's take a look at this slide, see what's on this slide right here. Oh, well, here is a stimulus. Here's a sensor. Here's what, a nice afferent neuron, which is a unipolar neuron, and we can see it entering the spinal cord. And then it's going to stimulate the motor neuron to withdraw from this painful stimulus right here. But this interneuron is also going to send information up to the brain so that you have conscious awareness of what's happening to your body. Where you have conscious awareness is in your brain. And as a matter of fact, this superficial region of the brain right here. And we talked about if you have an organ, it's got two main locations. There's a location on the periphery or the superficial part of the organ as opposed to something that's deep inside the organ. What do we, like bone. What is the superficial part of the bone called?
Cortical.
Yeah, that's cortical bone or the cortex. What's the deeper part of a bone? The medullary part of the bone. So this part of the brain, would you call this the medulla or the cortex? Yeah, that's the cerebral cortex. And when these neurons here receive action potentials or when they depolarize, that's what produces your consciousness. All right, so you have consciousness when what ions are moving here? When they depolarize? Sodium. And which way is sodium going to move? Inside the cell. And then you have your awareness. You have consciousness when that happens. Right, now if you want to know how that happens, you'll have to talk to me outside of class. But I probably couldn't tell you because I don't think anybody knows exactly why you have consciousness. All right, we know some physical events, but why it happens the way it does, I don't think we really know yet. But we know what parts of the brain are responsible for different sensations and different feelings and different perception. Okay. All right, so what did we want to talk about? Ah, different kinds of circuits. All right, here we see, let me really zoom in. And here we see, well, what does that look like? Purple? Fuchsia? Purple, okay. It was darker than blue, so I knew it wasn't really blue. Here we have an interneuron, and we can see one axon coming over here, but where is the other axon going? It's moving across the spinal cord and going up to the brain. So this kind of neuron is sharing information because it's bifurcating. We call that a divergent circuit. So let's look at some other circuits that we have in the brain. So that would be a good example. Okay, so here are some different types of neuronal circuits. Diverging is when you have one neuron and it bifurcates and it sends information to different parts of the body. Right, this is important for sharing information. For instance, when this neuron here depolarizes, it might stimulate a muscle to contract, but it's also going to send information to your brain saying that a certain part of your body is being damaged. So that's important. All right, here we have a converging circuit where there are many neurons sending information to some central place, maybe in the spinal cord, and then this neuron right here is going to make a decision on what to do based on what? All these four different kinds of information. So we call that converging. So this is actually integrating information up. It's adding information from various parts of your body before it makes a decision on what to do. Okay? And then this last one, let's look at this last one over here. We call this a reverberating circuit. And how many neurons do you see in this circuit right here? I see three. Here's one, here's two, here's three. Notice that this middle one has, right, a diverging pathway, and where does it go? It goes back to the first neuron. So when this first neuron is excited, when it depolarizes, it sends an action potential to the second neuron. The second neuron transmits the information to the third neuron. It passes that information on. But what else does the second neuron do? It sends that stimulus information back to the first neuron, which does what? Sends the information back to the second one, which does what? Sends it back to the first one, which sends it to the second one, which does what? Sends it back to the first one, which sends it to the second one, which does what? Sends it back to the first one. All right. Now that might seem a little silly, but that is really important. As a matter of fact, hopefully that's happening to you right now. That's a reverberating circuit, which does what? Well, the first time it happens would be like when the alarm clock goes off. All right, when you're sleeping. And what do? You wake up, and what are you able to do for the next 10 or 12 hours or so? Maintain consciousness. Stay awake, because this reverberating circuit right here has been activated, and that's what keeps you awake. Okay? And we're going to see when we get to the central nervous system really soon where that reverberating circuit is, but that's a problem for some people. This second neuron right here doesn't work, or it becomes fatigued very quickly. And if it becomes fatigued, what happens to somebody? They fall asleep. They lose consciousness. And you know what? That happens to some people. They can be driving down the 405 freeway, and if they have that condition, they can fall asleep. And then what happens? Well, yeah, it's a big mess for everybody. So people with that condition, guess what happens to their driver's licenses? Man, they get yanked, right? Or you could be given a lecture in anatomy class, and then all of a sudden, just fall asleep. Okay, it seems a little bit funny, but that's really a terrible condition when that happens to somebody. And it's really hard to diagnose because it involves a lot of different parts of the brain. Does anybody know what that condition is called? That would be narcolepsy, when you inappropriately fall asleep without any kind of warning whatsoever. All right, because there is damage to this reverberating circuit. Okay. So does that happen to anybody in here? Okay. I mean, there are times when you're tired and you just fall asleep. There's times when if I'm working really hard and I go home late at night, I'm stuck in traffic, I might have a tendency like to want to fall asleep, but not quite fall asleep, right? All right. Here's another kind of processing. Serial processing is when we have one neuron, it excites a second neuron, which then sends the information to a third neuron. And we kind of looked at that, where this is a sensory neuron sending information to an association neuron, and then this association neuron sends information way up to the brain, as well as maybe sending information down to a muscle to contract or something. That's serial processing. But our brain is mostly set up with parallel processing, where one neuron, we see it bifurcating or trifurcating, and then it shares information with more neurons, and this information is shared through different kinds of pathways. So these different pathways will use that information in different ways. Maybe this pathway right here will be used to adjust your heart rate. maybe this pathway right here is going to be used to adjust your respiratory rate. And this pathway right here is going to be used to adjust some hormone levels in your body based on this one kind of information. So this is parallel processing. And what's kind of fascinating about this figure right here, I kind of see this area, this serial processing is how you experience television. But this pathway over here is how you interact with not just television, but what's another visual form of entertainment and learning, which most people find much more entertaining and much more life-enhancing. For instance, when you're on the internet. When you're on the internet, what do? You click on something, and then what's available to you? Like a million other things, right? You can take other pathways to other kinds of information. And a lot of times when I'm on the internet and I click on something and I see three or four different pathways or other hyperlinks, I say, I need to go to this hyperlink, but I don't want to forget about these others over here. I want to go back to it, right? And so the internet is so fascinating to a lot of people because it's based on this parallel processing, parallel distributive learning, right? Unlike just listening to the radio or TV, you're just what? You're just kind of, you got to go with the flow. You can't change what's going there. But the internet, you sure can. Okay, because of parallel processing. All right, so that's it for the introduction to nervous system. Oh, no, we got to go back. We got to go back to something. Okay, just like in bones, before we started studying a lot of bones, we had to look at a bunch of definitions of things. You know, like what was a process, what's a hole in a bone called, that kind of thing. Well, we need some definitions within the nervous system because I want to use these definitions. Okay. So let's start here and then I'll go back up. Gray matter. If we have a neuron, it's going to look gray. But if we have a neuron and it has a myelin sheath wrapped around it, myelin is a lipid, it's going to have kind of a whitish appearance. All right, so if we have a neuron that has no myelin around it, we call that gray matter. And if it has myelin around it, we call that white matter. Okay? All right, so those are the big distinctions. And myelin we see around axons, not around dendrites or cell bodies of cells. All right, so let's go back up to some nervous system terms. Gray matter, that's a group or a cluster of nerve cell bodies and maybe dendrites. All right, and in particular, gray matter we're going to find in the central nervous system. So let me see if I can find a picture. All right, so here we see that unipolar neuron. So this part of the neuron is going to look white because of myelin, but this part of the neuron is going to look gray because it doesn't have any myelin around it. And if there are dendrites sticking out, okay, that's not going to be myelinated either, so dendrites and cell bodies are going to give the appearance of grayness, the color of gray. But if it's a myelinated axon, it's going to have a white color to it. Okay, so gray matter is a group or cluster of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace in the body. And maybe you could think of central nervous system. All right, so why is it a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites? Why do we call that gray matter? Because they don't have any myelin around them, right? Only axons do. Okay, the central nervous system cortex. Showed you a picture of the cortex already. Where the heck was that? Surface of the brain, okay, and it just so happened that it was on top of the brain. Where was that? Right here. All right, and you saw a dark area right here, and you saw a lighter area deep inside the brain. So the cortex of the brain is dark. It's a gray color. It's not colored gray on this particular picture right here because in this area of the brain, you have groups of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and they're not myelinated. While these deeper parts of the brain are going to be white because what do we have in this part of the brain? Axons that are going someplace carrying information. And typically in our bodies, what does our body do with axons?
It myelinates them to make them faster, and when they become myelinated, they take on the appearance of being white, right? So I see white matter deep in the brain, gray matter on the surface of the brain, and here you can see that nerve cell body right there, right? Which is going to be gray matter. Okay. Nuclei. What does nucleus mean to you? It's one of those words that has all kinds of different meanings. Okay, nucleus is what? What did we learn about a nucleus so far? We looked at a cell, I think. Did we start with a cell way back when? Like 5 years ago, we looked at a cell. What's the nucleus of the cell? That's the center part that holds the DNA, protects the DNA. All right, do we have anybody ever taken a chemistry class in here? Raise your hand. All right, what does a nucleus mean in terms of chemistry? What does nucleus mean in terms of chemistry? It's the center of the atom, okay, so you got to go all the way back to atomic theory. It's the center of the atom that has neutrons and protons in it, but not electrons. Electrons are out in orbital someplace. All right, so nucleus means different things depending on the connotation, right? So the nucleus could be the center of an atom that has neutrons and protons. It could be the center of a cell that has chromosomes, but in terms of neuroanatomy, a nucleus means something totally different. And that's how it is in life. There could be one thing that has a lot of different names, or there could be one name that could have a lot of different meanings. Like what? Bill. What does Bill mean?
Man.
Could be a name of somebody. Could be man or woman, yeah, but usually man. A bill could be like a law. Oh, yeah, law. They just passed a good bill recently, right? Okay, that could be a bill, which is going to give you a bill. Which means what? That means it's going to be a note that you owe a lot of money. So it could be, or a bill could also mean that it has value, like a dollar bill, right? So bill has all kinds of different meanings depending on the context. The same thing for nucleus. Nucleus could be the center of the cell, could be the center of the atom. But a nucleus in neuroanatomy, right, is a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system, okay, like the brain. And I think I had it right here. Here is, and over here, is a nucleus of the brain. It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, okay? And since it's nerve cell bodies and dendrites, what color is it going to be? It's going to be gray. And so it stands out from the white matter in the central nervous system. And so those areas right there we call nuclei. Each one is a nucleus, which is different than what? The nucleus of an atom or a nucleus of a cell. It's just a bunch of nerve cell bodies someplace. Okay. Ganglion. A ganglion and a nucleus are pretty much exactly the same thing, with one exception. Where did we find the nucleus? Central nervous system or peripheral? Central nervous system. A ganglion is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites where? In the peripheral nervous system. And did I show you an example of that already? In particular, right here. Right? This is peripheral nervous system. This is what we call the dorsal root ganglion because it's in the peripheral nervous system, but it's what? Just a group of nerve cell bodies. This is myelinated, but these guys in here are not myelinated. So they look gray. That's a ganglion. And what else? White matter. All right, tell me something about white matter. What part of a neuron is it? Axons. And it looks white because it's myelinated. And these axons are going someplace, so right, they're like roads or cables going places. That's axons with myelination. Okay. And then the last two things, so you know the difference between white matter and gray matter? White matter is nerve cell bodies and dendrites. Looks gray because it's not myelinated. White matter looks white because there are axons that are myelinated, right? So two different parts of a nerve fiber. A nerve tract and a nerve. These are kind of similar terms. We looked at a nerve already, right? A nerve is white matter in the peripheral nervous system, which means what? Axons that are myelinated that are going someplace, carrying information. Right, it's a bundle of nerve fibers going someplace. A nerve tract is pretty much the same thing, but where? In the central nervous system. So our central nervous system doesn't have nerves, it has tracts. The big difference is the location. Okay, so this dark area right here means nerve cell bodies and dendrites. This is gray matter in the spinal cord. But these areas in the periphery over here, more superficial areas, this is white matter because they contain axons that are myelinated. So this area right here is loaded with tracts that are either going up to the brain or bringing information down from the brain. And if it's a tract that is ascending, what kind of tract is that? Sensory tract. What's another name for a sensory tract? Afferent tract. And if it's this one right here, what kind of tract is that? That's an efferent or a motor tract, right? And remember, neurons can only carry information one way, either in the spinal cord, either up or down, because information cannot travel in both directions. All right, so here you see nice gray matter, and over here you see white matter. All right, so I think we're in pretty good shape to start talking about the central nervous system. Who's got a question before we go on to central nervous system? Nobody's got major questions? Okay. So we got about 10 minutes left, so I want to make sure that sign-in sheet is going around. Is that, anybody got the sign-in sheet? Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I notice a lot of people skipping classes, and you know, I'll have to use that as a decision to drop you from the class or not. If you're absent, right? Because I don't want people to end up with a bad grade. So my boss tells me I got to drop people that don't come to class, because otherwise you're going to get an F. Yeah, question.
Oh, I just want to make sure. We don't have a quiz on this Tuesday during spring break, right?
This is correct. No online quiz next week. But it is on, I think, the 6th. Okay. Now, how did it go with the quiz this week? Did it go okay? Well, maybe they fixed that problem. Okay. Now, for the next assignment, I think, in Blackboard it says you have 10 minutes, but I moved it up to 15 minutes. Okay. But if Blackboard starts to work properly, I'd rather have you just get it done in 10 minutes. Okay. So we'll let you see how it goes. All right. So I didn't penalize anybody. If you got the exclamation point, which means you went overtime, I didn't penalize anybody for the last couple of weeks because of that. But you guys should get all your notes ready together, study before you take the quiz, all right, because that helps you prepare for the lecture exam. All right, so if you take the quiz without studying, then it's kind of like wasted effort. You're getting points to pass the class, but what happens when you come take the test? Well, then you might bomb the test, and that doesn't help you, right? So prepare a lot for the quizzes. All right, this is good. All right, so let's just start to talk about the central nervous system. Uh-oh, what chapter is that? Is that 13? Chapter 13. And you know what? You know a lot about your brain already. So let's see where we're going to start. All right, so here we got a brain. What part of your nervous system is your brain? Central nervous system, and I see a little bit of spinal cord as well. Thank you so much. All right, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet before taking out off if you haven't done that already. Okay, so what kind of section does this look like that I have right here? Nice sagittal section, right? Okay, and in particular, this is a nice mid-sagittal section, right smack in the middle of the brain, okay? And we see a number of different things, right? So here is brain up over here, and then right down below it, we got spinal cord. How are you going to tell the difference between the brain and spinal cord? There's something right there that's separating the two. Even though they're directly connected to each other, there's something separating them. Okay, here's the pons right here. Here's the pons, and here's spinal cord. But there's a bone. What bone is this back here? Occipital bone, and there's a big hole. What's that big hole called? Foramen magnum, right? So the foramen magnum is the line of demarcation between the brain, which is superior to the foramen magnum, and everything below the foramen magnum is just called spinal cord, right? And that's about the only distinction that we're going to see right in this area. All right, so I tell you what, let me go look at this sheet right here. What is it? What am I going to say? Okay, let's talk about the five general areas of the central nervous system. I want to point them out to you that I see right here. All right, so what about spinal cord? Is that a part of CNS? Absolutely. So that's one of them. We can just barely see a little bit of it. All right, then just superior to the spinal cord is this area right here that we call the brain stem. Because the whole brain does what? It stems from this area down here. All right, and this is a really old part of the brain in an evolutionary sense. So even very crude or evolutionary unadvanced animals like reptiles and birds and things like that have a fairly well-developed brainstem. This is one of the first areas of the brain to develop. And the first part of the brainstem is the medulla oblongata. So here's the medulla. On top of that is the pons. Okay, so that's part of the brainstem. All right, and also the midbrain right here. Okay, the next part of the brain is the cerebellum. So we got spinal cord, brain stem, and cerebellum. It's a pretty big lobe of the brain, and it's important for controlling motor activity so that we can act coordinated when we're walking around. You know, every time we take a step, we're only just a fraction of a second from just smashing our nose into the ground. Right, it's really amazing that we can walk around without killing ourselves. And it's the cerebellum, right, that is usually, that's doing a big job in maintaining that coordination for us. All right, the pons in the medulla is important because it helps regulate your heart rate and respiratory rate, a lot of autonomic functions. All right, so we got, let's see, we got the brainstem, spinal cord, cerebellum. Another part is the diencephalon that we see in this color right here. This regulates a lot of autonomic functions in our body. It helps regulate body temperature and hunger and thirst. It helps regulate our endocrine system. I'm going to talk about more about these things after I give you a general overview. All right, so what are the areas that we talked about so far? Spinal cord, brainstem, cerebellum, diencephalon, which is kind of in the middle. And then the biggest part of the brain, and you guys probably can see the colors of all these things. This is the biggest part of the brain. That's the cerebrum, right? This is the most, this is the youngest part of the brain, but it's the most advanced part. And fortunately, this is what makes up humans and makes humans different than most other kinds of animals because of the cerebrum, okay? And in particular, the cerebral cortex. So these are the five areas of the central nervous system: spinal cord, brain stem, cerebellum, diencephalon, and cerebrum. And sometimes we call these cerebral hemispheres because you've got two of them. You've got one on the right and one on the left, and they're separated from each other. There's a big space between them. So you might ask, well, how does the right side of the brain know what the left side is thinking? And we're going to find out why that is, but in some people, it's damaged and one side of the brain doesn't know what the other side is doing. That is really fascinating when that happens, but really unfortunate for the person. Okay? All right, so that's it for today. So make sure you do your homework for Monday's lecture after spring break, because if you come to lecture and it's brand new material to you, especially nervous system, it like might go right over the top of your brain instead of going in. Please do your homework. Thank you.